Good evening. This is Maeve Russell in Carmel, California, in Pacific Grove, California. It's broadcast number 549, June the 14th, 1982. I have to get used to the city. We've moved from Carmel to Pacific Grove. Every broadcast begins with a tape number, in case you wondered. I've been on the air 11 years. I lost count some way. It really should be 572, but way back in the early time period, I lost track of the numbers. If I go out of town, I make broadcasts ahead of time and date them so that there's a continuous series of broadcasts, and I haven't lost 1 week in the past 11 years. Oh, 1 week I did, but that's a long story. I had a guest who fainted in the room after the first 5 minutes, and that didn't work out very well. The result of changing stations was very rewarding for me personally because of the response of people. It made me feel that some seeds have been planted, that people have understood what I've been trying to say, and I appreciate your response. There have been telephone calls for about 10 days, and everybody had something wonderful to say, and most of all, it was a broad range of people, young, old, all ages. It wasn't just the older people. This was explained at the other station. It wasn't that at all. And there were wonderful kinds of messages of what people have learned, and that was encouraging. I do want to say that there was another station here, very close to this station, Roger Powers, who did offer me to go on K-Ocean. And the reason I mention it is that Roger is a very conservative person politically. It's a privately owned station. Kazoo, the station that I am with now, that I decided to accept this invitation to be at this station, is a listener-sponsored station. But the spectrum of people listening or appreciating the research crossed over both ways, from the extreme right, if I can say that about Roger, to the left, or the group of people that are concerned with a broad range of changes taking place in our society and are willing to invest their time and energy to try and make these changes. It was heartening to see the stereotypes disappear and the kinds of people that responded to the kind of work I've done. I receive mail from you. I answer every letter. If you have questions about the broadcast, I'm listed in the telephone book. I'll answer your questions if they seem controversial to you and there's a new audience. Sometimes the names are confusing. I can't explain all of the names to you, but I can give you sources of information and books to read. Tape cassettes are available going back to March 1977. The motive or the purpose of my research is to watch history unfold to explain who are the people moving. Right now, the nuclear weapons, the large missiles, the space stations, who are the people controlling our government, and primarily with the weapons, because those are the things that are so dangerous. This is the week of demonstrations, nuclear discussions of the United Nations, and I'm sure that a whole generation that grew up during the 60s remember Monterey Pop and the Woodstock generation, and it must have been very heartening to see the kind of demonstration in New York City this last week. They said there were 500,000 in the newspaper. People that were there said it was closer to 750,000 or 1 million people. And there were some of the rock stars of the 60s, Joan Baez, James Taylor, Linda Ronstadt, Paul Simon. But the feeling there was that same kind of energy that started in the 60s before hard drugs and the mafia and the COINTEL program of Richard Nixon came in and smashed up what was a beautiful thing. And it was very encouraging for people back there to get to know each other and see people from all over the country. And what started in California, and this was really a grassroots California experience, where people left their homes in the East and came out to Haight-Ashbury and then down the coast and down Big Sur and in Monterey and all up north to various wooded areas on the West Coast. What started as a movement out here has spread across the country, so that Woodstock phenomena has spread south to New York and in Central America and the Middle America, and the middle class now is out there objecting to the warfare system, the warfare state. so that the ideas that began in the 60s during the Vietnam War are not over. People are out on the streets in San Francisco and the local area, children, backpacks, they demonstrated before, and they're visible again. Now, there's two things that you have to do to preserve this planet. One is be visible and go to the demonstrations and be seen. It's terribly important to be seen, to let the power structure know that you're alive and that you care. And the second thing is that you have to be educated. Information is a weapon, and you have to use it. And that's my role in sharing my research with you and being on the air all these years and writing and so forth, is that if you're not educated to the people behind the power structure, you'll get more of the same, only worse, as the years go on. After the Vietnam War, people assumed the war was over and went back to whatever they had to do. And William Colby, who ran the Phoenix program and claimed at his confirmation hearings that he had killed 30 or 40,000 people and was notorious in the torture chambers over in Southeast Asia, became the director of the CIA at home. Well, if he had the expertise over there and he comes home and uses that same expertise here, you can expect more of it around the world. So the main thing that I want to stress, and I always have mentioned, is that being visible is important, writing letters, getting on radio talk shows, listening to other people express their research, read books on the subject, and then become knowledgeable, because in order to survive, you have to do both. It's impossible to know it in your head and not get out there in some way in front of the people. That will not make any impression, and it's not wise to be out on the streets demonstrating and being physically seen and then not knowing who is in control of the government. And more important, how they got there. That's the main thing. Because the area that I've researched for almost 20 years now has to do with the way these people take power in this country and assume power in other countries, specifically through murder and assassinations. And I've always believed that if we could pin them down to those acts, which they in fact did, we could remove them from power and then start all over and insist that we don't have criminals, war criminals, Nazi war criminals, murderers, running the White House. It has been my allegation for many, many years that there was a coup d'etat in Dallas, Texas, November 22nd, 1963, and that all the people that have been in control ever since, the main people, can go right back to that date, that time and place, and were a part of that history and had some part of the murder of John Kennedy or the cover-up of the murder. And they are causing so much trouble in the world today, and many of them are still alive and very powerful. And these are the people that I constantly try to expose for what they're doing today and then take you back to the time when they were involved in Dallas in the killing of John Kennedy or Robert Kennedy or Reverend Martin Luther King or Malcolm X. And in fact, I believe we have death squads in this country similar to Brazil and Argentina, and they've been responsible for thousands of deaths. Now, one matter before I go on this evening, the bulk of the evening is going to be on Watergate. It's the 10th anniversary of Watergate. Great Britain captured Alfredo Astiz down in the Falklands at South Georgia. He was signed down there. He is a known torturer, murderer, killing the left-wing guerrillas and their sympathizers and rounding up people as a double agent. He has been written about in Amnesty International. The French want him for killing nuns. The Swedish want him for murder, besides people in Argentina. The British brought him home to Great Britain, and this week they released him, and he's on his way back to Argentina. I understand why they do it, because I believe that Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan are fascists, and they don't care if these people are killing members of the poorer class, the labor leaders, the farmers, the people that want to educate and organize themselves. They released him. He is a rotten person, and he should have been sent to the countries that wanted him for the murders. In the issue of Covert Action, this is March 1982, they have an article, Argentina activates its international death squads. That doesn't mean they stopped them. They activated them, even though the top people in our government have been playing with the Argentine junta all along and encouraged them for the actions they've been doing. And this article says the blonde angel, remember the angel of death at Auschwitz? Well, he's the blonde angel, Lieutenant Astes. There's a picture of him in covert action, this last issue that came out in March. He infiltrates citizens' groups. He's responsible for a place called La Escuela, translated the school. They have over 4,700 men, women, and children that were arrested there, and only 100 survived. He's in charge of torture, of disappearing children, and infiltrating groups, kidnapping, and torture. He was picked up at Pretoria June 20, 1979, as a naval attaché. And instead of turning him over to the countries where he could be tried for the crimes, he's going to be back in Argentina doing the same thing he did before and doing it well, and the Allies have allowed him to return. This is one reason it's so hard to get a handle on these various people when you catch them, such as Adolf Eichmann, who the Americans had after World War II, and then let him go down to South America, or Joseph Mengele's or Martin Bormann. We are breeding these people down there for decapitations, for mass murder, for killing the native population, the Indian population throughout all South America and Central America. And the blood is part of the responsibility of people like Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, because they had them and they returned them, and it's a real tragedy. Now, this is the 10th anniversary of Watergate, and I have a lot of fond memories of the entire era of Watergate. I'm going to run down some important dates for you, because there is no explanation 10 years later of Watergate that holds as well as what I wrote within 3 weeks after the rest of the Watergate Hotel. There's been hundreds and hundreds of books on Watergate. CBS is doing a program this week on Watergate. The people who made this production came in from Texas. It's produced by Dallas oil man Bill Moses and Nancy Dickerson. They were at the Watergate Hotel last week. There was a party, and they were the guests. They made the movie 784 Days That Changed America. But at the party were Chief Justice and Mrs. Warren Burger, our Attorney General, and his wife, William French Smith, CIA Director Bill Casey, and the German ambassador and his wife, and the British ambassador and his wife, and other people. So the hierarchy from Germany and Great Britain and the United States CIA and the Chief Justice attended a party given by Baron H.H. Thyssen Bornemisza from Switzerland and Germany with his Brazilian wife at the Watergate Hotel. So 10 years later, they're laughing at us, and goodness knows they have reason to laugh, because my explanation of Watergate when it happened was that it was a change of power in the United States, and I wasn't original in this. I'll give you the sources of information in case some of you don't remember this. But the purpose was to slide out Richard Nixon and get Spiro Agnew in as president, representing the real military junta, the fascist element of the United States. Nixon caught on and pulled the rug out from Agnew, and then put in his pal Gerry Ford, who was also on the Warren Commission to cover up the murder of John Kennedy. Nixon was in Dallas the day John Kennedy was murdered, and there was a transition of power, namely to Alexander Haig, Henry Kissinger, and the Pentagon totally took over the White House from that time on. Now, Watergate really began June 13, 1971, as far as I was concerned. That's when the Pentagon Papers came out. They told about how the government lied in Southeast Asia, how we were in collusion with the murder of Diem and his brother-in-law and brother. The American government had concealed the war in Southeast Asia and the plans for a long time. So the Pentagon Papers came out June 13, 1971, and I started doing my broadcasting that same week to do an interpretation of the Pentagon Papers and what they meant. And I said at that very first broadcast 11 years ago that the meaning of the Pentagon Papers was the continuous process not only of killing Diem, but John Kennedy a month later, and the same people that killed him killed the President of the United States, and that the war was another method of controlling Southeast Asia, a political plan that had started since World War II, and the murder of Kennedy fit right into the same operators of the Pentagon Papers that were described. Interesting enough, at the time of Watergate, when the men were arrested, E. Howard Hunt had on his desk a razor with glue and tapes, the State Department top secret documents, and he was forging them to say that John Kennedy was responsible for the murder of Diem. So our taxpayers were giving him $100 a day in the White House with scissors and glue to change the history around and make Kennedy a murderer posthumously. Now, the influence of the Pentagon Papers caused Lewis Tackwood, the police agent from Los Angeles Criminal Conspiracy Section, to come forward and meet with Don Fried and other researchers in Los Angeles. And at the Los Angeles Press Club, October 25th, 1971, Tackwood explained at that press conference that the Squad 19 in San Diego at the time of the conventions was going to kidnap the anti-war protesters. They were going to cause mass violence with the possibility of killing Richard Nixon down there, and that his agents in the White House were a Mr. Martin and a Mr. White, and that the Los Angeles Police Department was controlled by the CIA and the FBI, and he wanted out. He didn't want any part of this violence. He was influenced by the Pentagon Papers and what Daniel Ellsberg said. So at the press conference, he talked about the espionage squad in the White House, about Mr. Martin and Mr. White, and the murders and violence that were going to be planned in 1972, and the hiring of provocateurs. And after Watergate arrests, all this turned out to be true. And there was an article in the New York Times that covered the press coverage, and Leroy Ahrens of the Washington Post. But it really was silence with the news media, and nothing more was said about that, even though he was trying to tell this country what was going on. And simultaneously, in 1971, while he was saying this, Henry Kissinger took over the National Security Council. Richard Nixon had made him chief of the National Security, and he began to redesign the whole National Security Council and the White House to his own liking. He took over literally the State Department, the Defense Department, and the Central Intelligence Agency. And Henry Kissinger, who was doing all that, had been working with Nelson Rockefeller and David Rockefeller and had catapulted his career from Harvard to the National Security Council when Richard Nixon came to power. So what Lewis Tackwood was talking about was indeed happening simultaneously in 1971 in the White House. Kissinger had moved in, and if you notice with all the Watergate stories, Kissinger and Haig come out as the great saviors of the administration, not as the betrayers. They come out on top, still interviewed in the news as if they did something great. Now, June 17, 1972, it'll be 10 years ago this week, the men were arrested at the Watergate Hotel. Five men were arrested, and nine were registered at the hotel. And when there was James McCord, went to the police station. He got himself registered as Mr. Martin. And the men had in their pocket at the time the name of Mr. White. So I knew immediately that this was the team that Lewis Tackwood was talking about. I had contacted him after his press conference in 1971 because if he worked for the police department in L.A., he might know who was behind the murder of Robert Kennedy because he was working for them at the same time. So I was in touch with Lewis Tackwood and Don Fried up to the time of the arrest at Watergate. And the minute they were arrested, I picked up the telephone and called Bernard Fensterwald, an attorney in Washington, D.C., who works for the CIA, who had been in Carmel, California, at my home for 3 days. And I said, you know who they caught last night? And he said, who? I said, I know he knows who, but I said, it's the men who killed John Kennedy. Those are the guys. They caught him at the Watergate Hotel. Well, it was 9 months later when James McCord broke the story with Judge John Sirica, and he presented his attorney, Bernard Fensterwald, and then began to unfold the whole story that I had written about in the meantime in my Realist article about the changeover of the government. I had written a story on the plans of a coup in the country, the plans to kill Richard Nixon, and the threats to our freedom, as I say, kidnapping people and taking them away, that there was this inside team that was planning a military coup d'etat. As a matter of fact, in E. Howard Hunt's desk, there were wire walkie-talkies, wire equipment, radio equipment, a gun in his desk at the White House. He had all the accoutrements of a coup and road maps of Washington and streets to cut off, and this was part of his operation inside the White House that they were planning for that fall at the time of the conventions. Now, the White House tapes came out after a long time after I'd published my article, But there are several comments that I just want to share with you now that are interesting. June 20th, 1972, the arrest was June 17th, and Charles Colson was talking to Richard Nixon, and Colson was saying, I was thinking about this past weekend, what happened, and I figured maybe it's the Cubans that did it, meaning the Watergate problems. Organizing it on their own, you know, they had the, and then there's unintelligible. Then Richard Nixon said, I saw a paper when I was in there, and it says Kennedy. Oh, he was a public enemy, number one, for those Cubans. And Colson said, oh, they're violent. You know, Mr. President, most of them keep. And that was it. John Kennedy was the number one target of the Cubans. And Richard Nixon, 3 days after the Watergate arrest, was probably worrying about his own life and what the Cubans would do for him. They had been brought up to Washington for the funeral of J. Edgar Hoover in May, a month before, for demonstrations, and turned out to be pretty violent. And Richard Nixon was worrying 3 days after the arrest about the Cubans and their violence and John Kennedy's demise. And then in the same conversation, June 20th, 1972, he was talking some more about the Bay of Pigs, and he refers to members of the Watergate burglary squad who had been recruited from the Cuban exile community in Miami by E. Howard Hunt. He's talking with Charles Colson. E. Howard Hunt was the White House aide at the CIA who assisted with the Bay of Pigs operation and all these various Cubans. Mr. Colson, a friend of Mr. Hunt's, said he found it hard to believe that Mr. Hunt was involved in the Watergate matter because of the way it was botched. He's just too damn shrewd. And Nixon said, it doesn't sound like a skillful job. If we didn't know better, I would have thought it was deliberately botched. So 3 days after the arrest, Nixon is catching on that maybe it was deliberately botched. This was in June. And by August, 2 months later, Spiro Agnew was being investigated, and I'm sure this was what instigated this was the suspicion that Agnew would take his place, so he wanted to make sure to get him out. So by August the 6th, 2 months later, Elliot Richardson told Richard Nixon that he was beginning the investigation on his vice president. Now, the judge who prosecuted Agnew defended his decisions just last year, and he said the reason he did it, and he broke his silence, the federal judge in Virginia, he said there was the possibility that he would be a president, and he had to block his presidency. So as soon as the men were arrested at Watergate, one of the first things on tape that Richard Nixon was worrying about was the people that killed Kennedy. And keep in mind that Lewis Tackwood said they were planning to kill Nixon, and if they couldn't kill him, they could slide him out with a piece of tape, and that worked just as well. The transfer of power actually took place because they taped the president and botched this burglary and linked the two and then produced the tapes. And Nixon caught on. He worried about who killed Kennedy. He worried about the Cubans. He thought it could be deliberately botched. He pulled the rug out of Agnew 2 months later. And then the judge, just in October the 4th, 1980, said the reason he decided to let him cop a plea of no contest was that it blocked the possible Agnew presidency. So there was a power grab going on all this time. Now, simultaneously with this, in May of 72, this was 2 months before the Watergate arrests, the acting director of the FBI was sending memos out about the danger of John Lennon, that he was a danger to this country, and I have an FBI report dated May 25th, and Mr. Schiano, the head of Immigration Services, wrote to the FBI, and he advised that he considered requesting them to put a hold on Yoko Ono and John Lennon and go ahead with the deportation proceedings because they received information that the Lennons were planning a large rock concert in Miami. Now, the reason I'm throwing the Lennons into this story was that in May, before the Watergate story broke, before they were arrested, the Lennons were a threat to the establishment for the serious crime of a rock concert in Miami. And then I have another FBI report in June. This is June the 5th, and the Watergate arrest began June 17th. And they advised again of the danger of the Lennons, that Lennon and his wife are planning a rock concert in Miami at the time of the conventions, and they were going to try and get them out of the country. Well, when the men were arrested at the Watergate Hotel, I began my article, a three-part article. Many of you have it. Some of you don't. It was called, Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped? And it's the story of the actual kidnapping of Martha Mitchell that was verified by James McCord later, and the importance of injecting her, the attorney general's wife, and keeping and promoting the men who did this to her instead of firing them or investigating it. And it was a three-part link of American assassinations and how Richard Nixon really came to power by bringing Nazis into this country. It covered this article in The Realist, a large spectrum of American history going back to the end of World War II and right up to Watergate and the injection and the kidnapping of the attorney general's wife. Well, when Paul Krasner got the article, I worked for 3 weeks, night and day. I didn't do anything else but that. He had no money to get the Realist out. He was broke. He was living on the West Coast. He had 100,000 readers. He had no money. And he was in San Francisco, and he knew Yoko Ono from earlier in New York City, from the art galleries and different activities he was in. And Yoko and John put up the $5,000 to get this story out. And that's how my first published article came out. It turned out later that the State Department fellow, the immigration official who was deporting the Lennons, resigned on the basis that the deportation proceedings protected Nazis in America, and specifically Nikolai Maloxa of the Iron Guard, and wanted to deport the Lennons. And the same fellow who was involved in the deportation was furious for the Immigration and State Department for combining the Lennons into the Nazi war criminals, and he left the State Department. And the Nikolai Maloxa, of course, was the man who came to Richard Nixon's office at Whittier. He had a dummy front called Western Tube, and that was the same Nazi team of the Iron Guard that Richard Nixon was bringing to his office. Now, right after they put up the money for this article, there was another FBI report on the Lennons. This is dated August the 30th. They not only were giving a rock concert in Miami, but now they were linked to the New Left. It says, for the past several months, there's been information received to indicate that the subject is active in the New Left. Well, Paul Krasner had instigated and given the title to the Yippies at the Chicago conventions, but after we had gotten together with the Lennons, they'd put up the article. I had a meeting at the L.A. Press Club where I presented my Watergate story on the planned coup in America to tighten up the military control of this country. As soon as they got involved with us, they were targets of the immigration that they were New Left. But I also think it protected their being in this country, because then on the basis of national security, their past files were locked up, but they weren't deported, and they were allowed to come and go to this country. So there was something to be saved about this. I'm going to take a one-minute break now and come back with some more on the history of Watergate and how the power changed hands at that time.